this time last year, I was over my friend's house, and we went to go over her house to celebrate the new moon. And on the new moon, you can like ask for help in some way. And I was like, please, God, the moon, the universe, like whatever it is out there, please just help me get over this eating disorder.
I'm Tanner with the Office of Sustainability at the College of Charleston. Today's Social Sustainability podcast is focused on eating disorders, what they are, how they affect people's lives, and the barriers that prevent people from getting treatment. Two College of Charleston students, Megan Carpenter and Mary Welch, share their personal experiences. Additionally, I interviewed Dr. Reinecke, who is the director of the MUSC Friedman Center for Eating Disorders, to answer some questions about eating disorders and eating disorder treatment. Dr. Reinecke begins by explaining what an eating disorder is and signs and symptoms that someone might have an eating disorder.
According to the DSM-5, there are really four main eating disorders. So there's anorexia, which is generally when people are at too low of a weight. There's not a strict cutoff anymore for what constitutes too low of a weight, but leading to a significantly low body weight for that person based on their height, you know, gender, age, and growth history. So what's interesting about this is that if people are at like a heavier than average pre-morbid weight and then lose a bunch of weight to get down to like an average weight, they can still meet criteria for anorexia even though they're average weight because they've lost so much that it's too low for them. Then an intense fear of gaining weight or becoming fat, and then disturbance in the way one's body weight or shape is experienced, or denial of the seriousness of the low weight. Then there's bulimia nervosa, and that's primarily characterized by binge eating and purging. So binge eating, most people think of it as a large amount of food. It doesn't necessarily have to be. But an objective binge would be a large amount of food followed by a loss of control. Or accompanied by a loss of control. So feeling like they can't control what they're eating or how much they're eating or how fast they're eating, or feeling like they can't stop once they get started. And then following that with some sort of compensatory behavior, whether that's self-induced vomiting, laxative use, over-exercise, things like that. Self-evaluation, like with anorexia, self-evaluation is unduly influenced by shape or weight. So when you think about all the things that impact how someone feels about themselves as a person, shape and weight for them are like the most important. You can have a diagnosis of both anorexia and bulimia at the same time. So a diagnosis of anorexia sort of trumps a diagnosis of bulimia. Then there's binge eating disorder, where there's binge eating but no compensatory behavior. And then there's something called other specified, it used to be called eating disorder, not otherwise specified. Now it's other specified feeding or eating disorder. And that's basically sort of a residual category for people who have any clinically significant impairment or problems with, you know, eating and shape and weight, but who don't meet criteria for anorexia, bulimia, or binge eating disorder. There's no clear cause for an eating disorder. Eating disorders are very complicated illnesses. They're very multifactorial, and there's a lot of things that need to fall into place for someone to develop an eating disorder. So there's never one clear cause for developing it. But you know, some of the things that come into play are genetics. So 50 to 80% of the reason why someone develops an eating disorder is genetic. There are personality factors that come into play. So there are certain personality profiles that are more vulnerable to developing eating disorders. You know, everybody likes to blame sociocultural influences, which certainly don't help, but there's a lot more to it than that. We all live in the same sociocultural context, and not everyone develops an eating disorder, so there's got to be other things going on too. Biology can play a role, so there's a lot of things that need to fall into place.
What are some signs that someone might have an eating disorder?
So any significant change in weight, especially, you know, weight loss if they didn't need to lose weight, that's always a big indicator. Any sudden interest in, like, food shows or cookbooks or recipes or things like that, a sudden increase in preoccupation about food and eating is a big one. Any significant change in like fat talk or body image issues. And then there's more general sort of signs and symptoms like, you know, fatigue. If people aren't eating enough, then they're usually really tired. Social withdrawal, irritability is a big one. Efforts to try to get out of eating. So telling parents like, you know, I'm not hungry for dinner, I already ate, but really they didn't. Or like large amounts of food missing if they're binging, going to the bathroom, you know, multiple times during the day to purge. Those are all things that parents should look out for. Any evidence of visiting any pro-anorexia or pro-bulimia websites is always a cause for concern too.
Megan Carpenter shares her experience. She's also the reason I decided to do this topic for this podcast. She's a former intern at the Office of Sustainability and a current senior at the College of Charleston.
So I've had a range of eating disorders. I've struggled with it kind of since I can remember, but mostly since I was 8 years old. Didn't get really bad until high school. So I would take laxatives and overexercise as my form of purging, and restrict as well. So then like for the next however long, it could be anywhere from 2 weeks to 3 days, just like very restrictive in what I ate, exercise, and laxatives, and then I would binge again. And it really, really controlled my life. I started to develop diabetes. I developed hypothyroidism because of it. And I'm still recovering like from that to this day. Like my stomach, I still don't get quote unquote normal hunger cues. For me, my eating disorder was about control. I can't control what's going on in my life, so I'm gonna control the only thing that I can, which is my body. It was my way of feeling comfort, of being like, okay, I have some control over my life. So it was just like a whole lot of trauma. Growing up in a house that was very, you know, dysfunctional and codependent and not being taught how to cope with anything. My dad would say, oh, you're anxious, go to the gym. Oh, you're sad, go to the gym. My dad was constantly dieting. We even have like our own gym at my house. So my dad, he was he's always been kind of like obsessed with exercise. My sister was a D1 athlete. My mom was a gym coach. And then the school that I went to was very, very athletically competitive. So I was kind of like that weird artsy kid, just trying to fit in, like sort of. My mom, she had an eating disorder when she was my age. Mm-hmm. And there's been like a bunch of research that it's genetic or can be genetic in that way. So I'm not really sure if that contributed.
I also interviewed Mary Welch, who shares her experience. She is another senior at the College of Charleston, as well as the president of the Human Rights Alliance on campus.
So my eating disorder was not a typical one. It was a type of bulimia, but rather than your typical bulimia where you purge through throwing up, my type of purging was fasting, so not eating very much or at all, and then overexercise, and then I also had binge associated with that, which created the bulimia type disorder. I had a lot of like dizziness and, you know, just general weakness, things that they typically associate with like anorexia, I felt but didn't realize I was feeling. Like in the winter times, I could not stop being cold throughout the winter time. It felt like it was stuck in my bones and like so deep and so raw that like I honestly could not move most winters. It felt like that way. Obviously I got through it, but it was just something that like physically, until I realized what was going on, I didn't realize why it felt so shit sometimes. Mm-hmm. And there were just times where I was like literally just like constantly cold, constantly weak, like could not breathe sometimes. And then I realized my body was just very confused, and often a little bit starved. I was vegan at the time. I was vegan for about 3 years during my eating disorder, which was both a cover for and exacerbated my eating disorder, unfortunately. And it was something that was a good excuse for the reasons that my eating disorder didn't want me to go out in public often. So like a lot of times you'll do things like eating with people or like you'll grab a snack with somebody, or, you know, a lot of social stuff involves food. And my eating disorder made me not want to eat ever around people. And so, like, I was able to use veganism as like a mask of like, oh, I just can't eat that. That's why I'm not eating with y'all. But it really went a lot deeper than that. And that really did affect a lot of my social relationships, even though it didn't seem, it was very easy to cover up. It also affected my social relationships because I never thought like I was enough. I never thought I was pretty enough. I was constantly worried about what I looked like. Like, any situation, I wouldn't even be able to focus on like what my friends were talking about, or like really truly like connect to people in the same way, because I was worried about myself and my body just constantly. And like, yeah, that's really narcissistic, but it's like, it comes from this deep rooted, like deep seated insecurity. In this place of like absolutely just like tearing myself down, constant repetitive thoughts and worries about my body and about the way that I was presenting to other people. Like, I would even stop in between every class. I wouldn't really be able to walk to classes with people because like I would stop and go to the bathroom to check my hair, or like stop and go to the bathroom to look at my body and make sure I was like looking skinny enough or like looking okay. And of course I never was.
I wanted those that I interviewed to share what they thought the biggest myths and misconceptions were surrounding eating disorders and what they wish people knew about it.
It's been really hard. A lot of people have trouble understanding eating disorders. You don't need alcohol. You don't need drugs. You need food. So it's like, even to this day, every meal, there are things that I have to be thinking about. Every meal, every snack, that can be 5 times a day. With food, you know, It's everywhere, you know, commercials, conversation, friends, like it's social. Same with alcoholism or alcohol. It's also all over the TV and everything. So I'm not going to say one is harder than the other, because I've seen both, and I wish people would more understand that it is a disease and that it is an addiction, and just like kind of how hard those things are.
There's the typical one. There's the myth that everybody is starting to talk about, but the myth that like people who have eating disorders look a certain way. I mean, I legitimately was a size 6. That was like the skinniest I could ever get to, was a size 6. And now I'm a size 10 to 12, and like that's what's healthy for me. But like, I was starving myself for like a while, and I could starve myself for a couple of months and still wouldn't get below a size 6, and that's like a very average size. So it's not, you know, it's obviously not that anybody looks a certain way when they have an eating disorder. I would also say like an eating disorder itself doesn't look the way that people think, like not just the physical person who has one, but like most people can understand having times where you eat a lot and then after that like going a day with less food, or, you know, over-exercising for a week. People can kind of understand, I think, the thought process behind that, but some people don't really see that as like an eating disorder or even symptoms of an eating disorder. Another thing is like, you don't necessarily have to have an eating disorder to have disordered eating. That's still a big problem. You don't have to have a full-blown eating disorder in order for it to be something that's affecting your life.
I would say one of the biggest ones is that dysfunctional families cause eating disorders. There's no evidence that parents cause eating disorders. This doesn't mean that everyone who has an eating disorder comes from a beautifully functional family, but there's just no evidence that parents do. And I think for a long time, parents were excluded from treatment. And really that's changed in the last, you know, 40 or so years in the field, and parents are really seen as the biggest resource in their child's recovery. So I think the role of parents and the conceptualization of parents, both in the onset and course and in the treatment of eating disorders, has changed a lot. So that's one. I would say another is that once you have an eating disorder, you always have an eating disorder. It's a really popular misconception, but it's definitely not true. I think especially if you catch kids early and you give them effective treatments, then the chances of them really truly getting better and putting it behind them are pretty good. I think this idea that once you have an eating disorder, you always have one, is based on old research where the treatments really weren't that good. And I think the treatment landscape for eating disorders has changed dramatically in the last 40 years. And we have treatments now that work. I think the idea that eating disorders are always about control is another big one. For some people that might be true, but for a lot of people it's not. And one of the problems with that is that it gives this sort of false sense that the person who is refusing to eat is in control of what's going on, when really they're not. It's the eating disorder that's in control, right? So I think that's another big misconception. If you have like a sub-threshold eating disorder, like eating disorder, well, now it's called other specified feeding or eating disorder, that it's not as serious as a full-blown, you know, anorexia or bulimia diagnosis. And that's not true. You know, people who have sub-threshold levels of eating disorders need treatment, do just as well in treatment, and have the same sort of medical and psychological consequences of disordered eating. So just because you don't meet full-blown criteria for a disorder doesn't mean that it's not serious and that you shouldn't get help really fast.
Eating disorders have the highest mortality rate of any other mental disorder and affect about 30 million people in the U.S. However, a lot of people that have an eating disorder are not able to receive treatment or the amount of treatment they need. One of the biggest reasons for this is the high cost of mental health care. With that in mind, I wanted to know what the people I interviewed felt were the biggest barriers for eating disorder treatment.
And the last thing I ever wanted to do was go to treatment. All my therapists had been like telling me that I should think about going, but I was like, hell fucking no, I am not doing that. Like, yeah. I've never been more terrified. I had the conversation with my parents. I was so scared about going to treatment that I contemplated being homeless, because my family were like, if you don't go to treatment, we're cutting you off and kicking you out. And I was like, fine. Like, I will be homeless because I'd rather be homeless than go to treatment. And
What was it about treatment that scared you so much?
Gaining weight. And there are a ton, I did so much research on training facilities or treatment facilities. A lot of the places do not have good meals, don't let you work out at all, like, and they're very hospital-esque. And I was like not down for that. The day that I went, I was so scared that I passed out. So the place that I chose to go to is called Mirasol. Very different than most treatment facilities. I would highly recommend it. It's holistic, and I chose it because they allow you to exercise and because it was in a hospital setting. They gave you like organic meals. They had like a chef for the house, like specific to the girls. Like, you could give them, like, most eating disorder facilities will not even, like, unless you have severe allergies, like, they won't let you have allergies. They won't let you have quote unquote dislikes. Like, I could have 2 dislikes of things that, like, on the menu that I like don't like. I chose horseradish and blue cheese, 2 things that I really hate. But like, a lot of people will be like, they'll try to go in and be vegan, or they'll try to go in and be gluten-free, and they can see that as being sorted. But I'm so glad I chose that place because it showed me how to exercise in a healthy way. But even then, they only let you exercise 3 times a week. It's very structured, like we either do yoga or go horseback riding or go on a hike. I had friends that had been to many different like treatment facilities, and they wouldn't even let you stand up because that would be considered like exercise or walking around. But that's what I hated about the other facilities. It was like, I didn't want to go somewhere just to get porked up. You know what I mean? And I liked Mirasol because A, they did get to their philosophy is about getting to the underlying root of your disorder. And they teach you how to live a healthy lifestyle, whereas like many treatment facilities don't do that. One of the parts that does suck about treatment is insurance. I saw women that could only afford to come for 2 weeks. That can't cure an eating disorder. I went for 3.5 months. And there are days where I don't think that was enough. I'm not fully recovered yet in some ways. It really takes time.
I think the biggest barrier, and obviously this is subjective depending on what your situation is, but I think for a lot of people, the biggest couple of barriers, first off, is going to be, you know, whether or not you actually have access, period. You know, treatment's expensive. It's a big hurdle. It's something you often have to talk to your parents about if you're like me, like I was a student. But also beyond that, there's this hurdle of even recognizing the fact that you have an eating disorder. Like, I genuinely did not know. I had absolutely no idea that I had an eating disorder. There's just no way to know what's normal and what's not normal. And often that's not even something that matters. Like, when you're in the middle of an eating disorder, it doesn't matter that you're sick a lot of the time. You don't care that you're killing your body or that you're hurting your body. So getting treatment doesn't even seem like on the list of priorities, because you're like, I'd rather be pretty. Period. End of story.
There are a lot of, for example, there are some residential programs that on the surface look very nice. You know, they have art therapy and they have horses and they look like a resort, and it looks like a nice place to send your kids if they were sick. But there is very little evidence that a lot of those places work well. So I think general caregiver knowledge about what is good treatment and what's not good treatment, and I think a lack of information about what constitutes evidence-based treatment and why it's a good idea to look for evidence-based treatments. I think also, you know, the medical field surprisingly doesn't get a ton of information, a ton of education about eating disorders. So there's some very good, you know, and well-meaning physicians that don't catch some of the warning signs. Physicians are often on the front line, you know, of identifying an eating disorder. And so maybe they'll see a kid start to fall off their growth curve, but they don't sort of raise the alarm. They just say, well, we'll wait and see what happens, or it's just a phase, they'll grow out of it. That's not the right approach. But parents go along with what the doctor says, you know? So I think a lot of times, you know, the medical field, the frontline intervention knowledge isn't always sufficient, and then parents don't always know what to look for. And then, of course, you know, there are always, you know, insurance issues and things like that that come into play. But I think really lack of education is probably the biggest one, and lack of trained eating disorder therapists. To be honest, there's not a whole lot of people out there who specialize in the treatment of eating disorders, and of those that do, there are not a whole lot of people who specialize in evidence-based practice. So getting a good eating disorder therapist is hard to do sometimes.
Besides treatment, the people in your life can play a huge role in eating disorder recovery. Dr. Reinecke explains her research on expressed emotion and how parents and family can play a role in someone's recovery.
Yeah, so expressed emotion is, I've done several papers on expressed emotion. It's not emotional expression, which is what it sounds like. So it's a measure of a relative's attitudes and behaviors toward an ill family member, whether that family member has a mental or a physical disorder. And it has five different components. So there's critical comments, hostility, emotional overinvolvement, warmth, and positive remarks. And those are all defined in very, very specific ways. But basically what we found with expressed emotion is that it predicts treatment outcome, it predicts treatment dropout, and it predicts relapse across a range of medical and psychiatric disorders. So it's a very interesting construct, I think, because it is so predictive of outcome. And it's also something that, you know, can be altered, you know, with education and with training and with support. I think you can change high negative expressed emotion is the kind that predicts the poor treatment outcome. You can change that in caregivers by giving them the right support and the right knowledge, and thereby theoretically improve patients' outcomes. So the way that I like to measure expressed emotion is with a family interview. It gives you the most information, I think, and probably the richest information that you can get. But it's time consuming and it can be costly to do. So I haven't been able to do expressed emotion interviews since I was at University of Chicago. Since then, I've been using self-report measures. So there's a couple self-report measures. The one I use is the family questionnaire. It just measures two of the five constructs or components, so critical comments and emotional over-involvement. But those are the two that seem to be most predictive of outcome for patients.
Similarly, Megan explains how those around her have played a role in her recovery.
My family would shame me for having triggers. When I came home from treatment, I told them my triggers and everything, fresh out of treatment. And they said, well, we're not gonna, I'll explain how I understand their side in a second. But they said, we're not gonna worry about that because we don't wanna have to change our lives or step on eggshells around you. I understand that, but if you really want me to heal, I'm fresh out of treatment. I'm not ready for that yet. It hurt that they weren't respecting my boundaries. And I also think that they were mad at me because I chose to go to the treatment facility that I wanted to go to and not the one that they wanted me to go to. I think that there's a time and there's definitely a time and a place to respect people's triggers. Like I said, no one likes to step on eggshells. So an example of something that someone could do is when I was in my relationship, I would say, it would be more helpful to me if you said, I love you for who you are, not just you're beautiful, your body's perfect, stay the way you are. When he said your body's perfect the way it is, that was very triggering. And if I could, and so I just asked him to change his words and he did. And that was very helpful. A lot of people think triggering, it just means offended. It doesn't mean offended, it means provoking, not maybe you don't necessarily have a mental illness, but provoking thoughts about a trauma you've had.
The purpose of this podcast is to share people's stories and experiences. Not everybody's experience with an eating disorder is going to be the same, but I hope you found this inspiring and informative. With that in mind, I wanted to end with a quote from Mary.
What would you tell somebody that's experiencing an eating disorder right now, that's currently going through that?
I would say thank you for still being here, because you still have so much to give. And I would say let go if you can. Say fuck it to everything and everyone that is telling you otherwise, because there are so many different ways to do life and so many different paths that you can take, and ultimately whichever one you take is okay, and being yourself is okay, and looking whatever way you look is fine.
Thanks for listening. If you'd like to hear more podcasts, you can go to synergies.cfc.edu.